Hey folks, welcome to the December 9th podcast from the table. On this particular date, Tim Penner, who's part of our community, led the talkie bit. And Tim's field of study and expertise is sort of this intersection between literature and film, working on his doctorate in that realm, and always very, very thoughtful approach to images and ideas and the intersections between those things. And also always very engaging in terms of the community participating. So the podcast is a little bit different in the sense that there's a fair bit of interaction on it, and Tim will reference some things that they've looked at, and he'll usually give good information about those things, so if you want to go see them, you can. But obviously there was a fair bit of imaging involved in this in terms of watching bits of films, including Charlie Brown Christmas, which was sort of the centerpiece of the morning in some ways, and which Tim works with together with the community in their discussion. So just a little preamble so you know what's going on if you're listening to this one. Enjoy Tim and the community's reflections on some of the Christmas movies and some of the ways they're structured and some of the ideas that that draws out in a sometimes very challenging, but potentially also very beautiful time of the year. Hope you enjoy.
Yeah, like I said, we're going to kind of be a little bit looser with this. If people want to throw in ideas or questions or whatever, you know, just put your hand up and we can do that. But I just want to start by talking about sort of these two kind of trends in Christmas movies that I think almost every Christmas movie you see falls into one of these two categories. Now, I haven't done a lot of research on all these Hallmark Christmas movies. I know there's like 1,000 of them. But I'm pretty sure every time I see one a little bit, I'm like, oh yeah, this fits into the one or the other. So the two are basically, there's the Scrooge story. So you have, you know, based on Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, where you have a main character who is curmudgeonly and angry about Christmas in some sort of way, goes through a sort of journey, sometimes supernatural, sometimes not, and then comes out at the other end feeling very excited and happy about Christmas, right? So you can look at pretty much, you know, all the Christmas Carol adaptations, of which there are millions probably. But you can also look at movies like Home Alone, right? Doesn't want his family, goes through his experience, happy with his family at the end. The Santa Claus with the E at the end, you know, Tim Allen isn't that crazy about Christmas. Then he becomes Santa Claus and gets into Christmas at the end. How the Grinch Stole Christmas, obviously. The Family Man with Nicolas Cage, which was on TV the other day, so that's why I made it in here, right? He sees what his life would be like if he had a family instead of lots of money, which I don't feel like is a, you know, one or the other.
It's kind of like a ripoff of It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, yeah, it fits into that, yeah. The Bishop's Wife, if anyone's seen that, with Cary Grant and David Niven, an older film. David Niven is a bishop who thinks that Christmas is all about getting money out of his parishioners to build a new cathedral. Cary Grant shows up and convinces him otherwise. Christmas with the Cranks, another Tim Allen, a lot of Tim Allen Christmas movies, where they have to like create Christmas. If I'm remembering it right, they create Christmas because their kids decide to come to town where they were trying to get away.
No, they were going to skip Christmas.
Yeah.
And then because their daughter wasn't going to come home.
Right.
The first time, so they were going to skip Christmas, and
yeah,
then their daughter at the last minute is like, I'm going to come home, and then they have to rush around.
Yeah.
It's really funny.
Yeah. I do remember, yeah, I remember laughing quite a bit.
Although the book is better, it's called Skipping Christmas.
Okay, all right. So check it out. Four Christmases, which Ray was talking about, right? Which I didn't think was that great. Kind of cheats at the end, but there again, there's this couple that lie every year to get away from their family. They say they're going on like humanitarian efforts, but usually they're just going to a resort for Christmas and they get caught. And Bad Santa with Billy Bob Thornton. You know, there's another one where he's sort of this curmudgeonly guy who gets turned around through this kid. So on the one end, there's that side, the Scrooge story. The other one that movies tend to fall into is this idea about the gap between, not the Gap, the clothing store, the gap between sort of expectations and reality when it comes to Christmas, right? So usually you have this conflict where a character is trying to accomplish a perfect Christmas or wants, feels bad about the way Christmas is playing out and goes through a series of things in which they come around or they come to some sort of realization, right? So Christmas Vacation, obviously, Chevy Chase is trying to make the perfect Christmas, but his family is making that very difficult. White Christmas is an older movie. Bing Crosby and Rosemary Clooney, they want this white snow Christmas, but they get to Vermont and it's been a heat wave, and so there's a whole series of plays around that. The Nightmare Before Christmas, right, what's his name? Jack something?
Jack Skellington. Burlington.
Yeah, right. He's trying to, like, bring Christmas to Halloween Town, right? Am I remembering that right? Okay. Elf, right? Will Ferrell wants to come and find his dad and have this perfect Christmas, and he has to bring Christmas to everyone else. Jingle All the Way, trying to do it through buying a toy. Christmas in Connecticut, another really old one, where they're trying to create this Christmas with their editor so they don't all get fired from their magazine. Rudolph Red-Nosed Reindeer, right? There's all of this. Rudolph wants to be a normal reindeer, and he's got this nose. There's also the elf that wants to be a dentist, and the Island of Misfit Toys, right? This whole group of toys that want to be something that they're not. Christmas Story, which I think is maybe the most perfect indictment of commercialization of Christmas in history.
You'll shoot your eye out.
Yeah, I mean, the epitome of Christmas in that story is literally a gun. And then the scene where he goes to see Santa, I think, is just like the perfect visual idea of what Christmas does to us all. Just kicks us in the face, pushes us down a slide. The commercial idea of Christmas, the sort of impossible expectations of Christmas, yeah. And then there's lots of movies where they blend the two. So It's a Wonderful Life, right, is this story about George Bailey, who, it's on one hand, it is a Scrooge story because he has to go through the supernatural experience to sort of come back to loving Christmas or loving his family or not committing suicide, basically. It's actually a really dark movie. And then there's also, on the other side, is this sort of, there's always this tension between what he expects out of his life in general and what's happening. And so it's, yeah, it's this really interesting kind of mixing, blending of those two different types of stories. Yeah. Can anyone think of a movie that doesn't fit into these categories?
One of the Doctor Who Christmas specials was okay. About these aliens that are stealing people's dreams, and Santa's the one that saves the day.
Okay. I haven't seen it. I wonder if
the Aliens, which is a B-movie that's awful, but it doesn't exactly fit.
Right, okay, all right. We can always find exceptions. But for the most part, I think the mainstream movies sort of fit in these two categories. So when we think about Charlie Brown Christmas, which category do you think we're in? Second one. Yeah, it's pretty obvious, right? Like, he starts off right off the bat saying, I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel, right? So, yeah, it's very much this movie about setting up the idea of what Christmas is supposed to be, right? This is what he keeps saying. I don't feel like I'm supposed to feel, and what he's experiencing. And it's interesting because there's lots of clues to this throughout the film, right? And it starts right off at the beginning with the music. We're not going to talk a ton about the music, although I think it's all very interesting. But this first song that comes on, right, is called Christmas Time Is Here, right? And if you listen to the words, there's a huge gap between what the words are saying and the sort of feel and tone of the music. So the words are, you know, Christmas time is here, happiness and cheer, fun for all that children call their favorite time of the year. Snowflakes in the air, carols everywhere, olden times and ancient rhymes of love and dreams to share. So there's, and then there's more, but it's all sort of in that tone, right? This is wonderful, it's Christmas time, there should be happiness and tradition and, you know, silver bells in the air and joyful memories and all of these kinds of ideas. But the tone of the song is in a decidedly minor key. It's very slow, very sort of dirgy almost. And it's the kind of song that if it didn't have words on it, you would never associate with Christmas, except that we have like 50 years of it being associated with Christmas.
It's very somber.
Yeah, very somber, right? And so it's this mix of the sort of expectations of the lyrics mixed with the reality of the melody, right? Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, but the lyrics sound like they belong to a more upbeat, happy kind of music, right?
Right.
But the music is very low-key, very somber.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's this interesting kind of thing that the producers choose to start their children's Christmas special with, is this very sad kind of music, right? And to introduce this character. And so right away, we are into this idea. If you're listening to the words, you're into this idea that there's something. We're going to be exploring that space in between throughout the movie. So what happens right away when Charlie Brown comes onto the film is he sort of declares almost like the thesis statement of the film, right? He says to Linus, I think there must be something wrong with me. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. And this is the key one. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel, right? So when we think about a sentence like that, and we think about Christmas, and we think about our own sort of experiences of Christmas. What do you think it means by supposed to in that sentence? What is Christmas supposed to feel like?
You're supposed to be happy and joyful.
Okay. What else?
Excited to run out and buy presents for people.
Yeah. You're supposed to enjoy shopping all of a sudden.
And think of all the people that you love.
Yeah.
What, and buy presents for them.
Yeah, and buy presents. Other things, you know, when you just think about your own experience, what am I supposed to be feeling right now?
You're supposed to be excited to, like, spend time with your family. You're supposed to feel like you look around, you're like, I have such a lovely life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this expectation that all of the trouble you have with your family the rest of the year won't be a problem because it's Christmas, right?
Well, you get together with family that you don't get along with, you know, and you're going to try and get along with them because it's Christmas, right? Mm. And you should have them there, and you should, you know, try and make amends, get along.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there's a lot of should-haves, right? Or shoulds.
Yeah. Obligation seems to come up.
Yeah.
All these things are just, you know, we're supposed to just put that on.
Right. And so, I mean, there is a lot of beauty in the idea of, like, if that could work, right? That you could get together with your family and reconcile and just, like, you know, I could really love being around my brothers for more than 10 minutes at Christmas. Like, is that going to happen? It doesn't necessarily happen for everyone. Some years I can say it has, but it doesn't always. Yeah, Lisa.
It is a lot about perfect.
Right.
And that unattainable desire for that, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe, like you said, once in a while, when you were very young, it happens, mm-hmm. but it's such a construct. So it's a lot of
yeah.
For that not going to happen thing.
Right.
Unless what? Unless everybody is perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and I think that's good what you say about being young too, right? There's sort of a desire to recreate this sort of memory of what was great about Christmas in your childhood. And again, we're talking about experiences and people's personal experiences. There may be people for whom every Christmas is that perfect, and that's wonderful, you know. But I think most people, they live in that gap, right? That Charlie Brown's talking about. They know how they know how they're told they're supposed to feel, but they don't feel that way, right? And so a lot of this gets reinforced through this commercialization of Christmas, right? So there's a set of expectations that go around traditions, family, food, and presents especially. And then I think if you add on to the layer of that, say someone who, for whom, you know, there isn't extra money at Christmas and so can't necessarily afford to buy the latest presents for their kids or for people that they want to, even if they might want to, or they go into a lot of debt, that adds to that layer, right? Is that I'm not able to make Christmas perfect because I can't buy the things that I need to buy to make it perfect, right? And so, yeah, this gets reinforced through this commercialization of Christmas, through commercials, through other, you know, different ways that this works, so that there's this narrative around Christmas that if you just do the right things, you will feel the way you're supposed to feel, right? And usually what that means in a commercial context is when you spend more money. So go shopping, you know, go online shopping or to the mall or whatever you're going to do, and if you just buy the right gifts for people, you will feel good about giving them, and maybe you will bring peace to your family finally, right? So like a movie like I mentioned quickly, Jingle All the Way, the whole thing is he needs to get this superhero toy for his kid and then his kid will be happy, right? And there's a lot of pressure around that, and that's why Tickle Me Elmo's sell for $300, you know, and parents want to sort of construct that narrative so that their kids are in this illusion that their kid will be happy with them and Christmas will be perfect.
Or there's this, you know, stupid pooping unicorn that costs $80. And
is that a real
there's
thing?
No way my daughter would have ever wanted it if she hadn't seen a YouTube video that was all like, oh, because it makes slime. The poop is slime that you then get to play with. She doesn't.
All right.
She doesn't want it.
Oh, that's good. Zoe.
No. She thinks she wants it.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
She doesn't actually want it.
Yeah.
She would probably play with it once or twice and then think it's the most ridiculous, stupid thing ever.
Yeah.
So there's no way she's gonna get it, and so she's gonna be disappointed.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because everyone else is buying it,
right?
And you know, they want it.
Yeah.
Everyone else has it.
Yeah. Then you want your
but
own.
I think part of that is like because we set up the myth of Santa. Mm-hmm. And there's this expectation that Santa's going to bring you what you write on your list.
Yeah.
And so then when you're asking Santa for these specific gifts that you know all the kids want, then the parents have this pressure to get that specific gift for the magic of Santa.
Yeah.
Which is like why we don't do Santa.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's like, no, the gifts come from us. And so if we can afford it, then you'll get that gift.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And if you can't, then sorry.
Yeah.
That's just not how it works. But I think that was a huge, and I grew up in poverty, so like I was this good kid who had straight A's and would write to Santa and ask for, you know, not even the biggest things, but I never got the gifts that I wanted because my mom just couldn't afford that.
Right.
So, yeah, like my parents.
Kids like me who were like, why did all my friends at school get all these presents they asked for and that they wrote their list for, and I never got one, and that was like so devastating as a kid, and so it just plays into that again, the expectation versus reality.
Yeah.
We almost work to create some of that ourselves because we do things like that.
Which is why my parents never taught about Santa. Like, they taught me about the story of St. Nicholas, but not about Santa. They gave me very strict warnings that I was not allowed to enlighten the other kids.
Don't burst the other
at school because that could be very, very bad.
Yeah.
But, yeah, because they knew. I got a pair of mitts 1 year for Christmas. That's what they could get me.
Yeah.
You know, and some people would take pity on us and give us a few gifts. But, you know, you go around and there's all these people, oh, are you excited for all the gifts you're going to get for Christmas? And in my head, I'd be like, no, because I'm not going to get a lot of gifts. So.
Yeah.
But I was also glad that, like, because I know now that if my parents had set me up believing in Santa Claus, that A, I would have thought Santa was a giant asshole. Or B, that I was somehow defective and a horrible person, and therefore not getting it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
It's interesting. They kind of did a sequel to this Christmas special back in, I think, the late 80s or early 90s, something like that. And Sally's writing an essay on what Christmas is about. And she said, Christmas is about getting. Christmas is about getting all you can. And Charlie Brown sees that and he says, no, it's not. It's about giving. And she says, I have no idea what you're talking about.
No, right. Sally, so we're going to get into some of the other characters on the periphery too as we go along. Holy smokes, how is it 10 to 12 already? Okay.
I think. Forget that we talk a lot?
Yeah, I know. You're much more talkative than my class. Yeah, there's an interesting sort of setup of throughout the film where this idea of sort of perfect gifts or perfect solutions will solve your problems, right? So one of the funniest parts is when he goes to see Lucy, the psychiatrist, right? And so she figures out, okay, I'm going to, first of all, I think it's a very cynical take on sort of the psychiatric community as a thing. And so, and the sort of commercialization of helping people, right? So she gets her nickel in her bucket and just along, nickels, love it. And then what she does is she proceeds to offer a bunch of quick solutions, right? So she lists off a bunch of phobias, hypangeophobia, the fear of responsibility, allurophobia, fear of cats, climacophobia, stairs, thalassophobia, the fear of oceans, fear of bridges, and pantophobia, the fear of everything, right? So there's this idea in that moment, too, that if she can just find the right prescription or the right problem, then she could just fix him and he'll no longer feel this way, right? And so the funny thing is, when she says pantophobia, he says, that's it, that's what I'm afraid of, right? And so I found I went on the internet to see a list of these things because I could not spell them. And so there was a website from like the American Psychiatric Association that was like, okay, so here's the list of things and if it's right or wrong according to the actual definitions. And so interestingly, pantophobia is not necessarily the fear of everything, but it's a condition of vague, non-specific anxiety. So it's not necessarily a specific thing, but it's kind of what Charlie Brown is feeling, right? He's got this vague, non-specific anxiety around Christmas. And so it's funny that he yells out, that's right. Because that's exactly what it is. And so, this, I think, connects to this idea of Christmas, of finding the right present, right? Your kids aren't getting along because they're fighting over your iPad. Well, buy them all iPads and then problem solved, right? I don't know if you can afford that, but that's the idea, right? Is of commercialization. It's just like get them all their own thing, and then they'll be happy with each other. They'll never speak to each other again because they'll be on their iPads. Of course, it's not going to work. So, Lucy's sort of recommendation, out of the, when she can't sort of fix him that way, is this idea of involvement, right? So this is the other big thing of Christmas time, right? Is just get involved in something, go shopping, is one of the big involvements, and it will fix these woes because you won't have time to think about how you're depressed about Christmas. You can just be in the, you know, the pageant, and then you can be rushing your kids to this thing, and then you know, you've got to do your shopping, and you've got to get your baking done, and all of these sorts of things, right? And it's like just get into an activity. And so she recommends that Charlie Brown directs the Christmas play, which I don't see how anyone could see the badness of that idea from a long way off, but he decides he's going to do it, which again becomes, we're not going to get too much into the play, but it again becomes this gap between expectation and reality. So he comes out there as the director, and he's got all these great ideas. You've got to pay attention to your director. I'm going to tell you to do this. We're going to do that. And then he says, action, and you know, what do all the kids do? They just start dancing around because they're a bunch of kids, right? And then there's this sort of the expectation that Charlie Brown has and the reality, and they aren't the same, right?
The Christmas play never actually happens in the special.
No, there's no play really. They have scripts, but nobody does anything. Yeah. Maybe they would do it after. I don't know, but it just doesn't sort of work. And so, but it's interesting the way these sort of Christmas extremes happen throughout the movie. So. He keeps sort of encountering characters who are very comfortable in whatever side they're on, right? So Snoopy is very comfortable with commercialization of Christmas. He's going to win money with his lights display. Lucy is very happy. You know, she sort of has this moment where you're set up for this joke, right? She's like, I never get what I really want. You think she's going to be sort of sentimental or whatever. She wants love. No, she wants real estate. And then you have...
That's kind of the first reference to commerciality. Yeah. She says that.
Yeah, and then of course Sally, right, is writing her letter, and she's like, "If you can't to Santa, if that's too much work, just send money or just send cash, right?"
Yeah, so
So there's that extreme, and then on the other side you have Linus, who sort of comes across as a kid who maybe gets the idea that it's not about presents and all that sort of stuff, right? And so he has his little speech where he quotes from, I think that's from Luke, but talks about sort of the true meaning of Christmas, right? Is this the sort of Christian religious idea of Christmas? That it's about Jesus and it's about God sort of showing grace and all that kind of stuff. And so he's at the other extreme, right? And so Charlie Brown is somewhere in the middle of that. And what I think is interesting about the film is the way that Charlie Brown never really gets to one side or the other, right? He never really leaves the gap. There's a moment where he's sort of happy. After Linus says that, he takes his tree and he kind of skips along, and he's got this momentary happiness, and then he tries to decorate the tree, and then he, oh, I killed it. And so he's sort of back in his thing. But it doesn't, in an interesting sort of turn, the other kids show up and just kind of accept him into the space. Anyway, and we're going to talk about the tree a little bit more in a minute, but I think there's something really interesting and insightful about this, in that he doesn't have to be cured for the rest of his community to take him in. They just sort of take him in, and he joins them in singing, and that's how it ends. And who knows, maybe they go back and do the play. We don't know, but it's not important to sort of the narrative. And I think that's a really insightful thing for a movie like this to do. And I think that comes down to Charles Schulz, who of course created Peanuts and was I think very comfortable with these ideas long before they sort of hit the mainstream. But yeah. Okay, that's so many pages. Why did I write so many pages? I want to talk about the tree a little bit, because the tree to me is really the most beautiful thing in the whole film. I remember when Jane and I first got married, we got a Charlie Brown Christmas tree, like these little ones you can buy in the store, commercially available, of course. No one notices the irony, but that's fine. And it was our first Christmas tree, and we've had it, and we actually went, all our stuff is in storage right now because we're in the middle of moving. We dug into our storage unit to find this tree and set it up in our house, or my parents' house where we're staying, just because and it's significant to me, and it's a nice thing for Addie. And it's interesting the way that the tree plays out, because it's again another big contrast between the expectation of Christmas in terms of what a Christmas tree represents and the reality, right? So they want him to go out and buy a bright, shiny aluminum Christmas tree, which is in fact a thing that I always thought was a joke. But in the 60s, you could get an entire tree made out of aluminum, and they were very popular. So they send him out to get this, and he comes back with this rickety little tree, a real tree, but one that the leaves are falling off. It's just barely anything. It's more like a twig. But he sort of sees the beauty in it and wants to buy that. And so I think what's interesting there in terms of this idea of expectation and reality is Christmas trees, somewhere along the line, are meant to be a metaphor for Christ. And I think this tree operates as a perfect kind of metaphor, a perfect metaphor for Christ in the nativity story, right? So if we look back in the Old Testament and we read some of the sort of prophecies around the Messiah, you know, if you read Isaiah, all the stuff in like Handel's Messiah, right? It talks about, for unto us a child is born, the government shall be on his shoulders, his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. The increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end upon the throne of David, upon his kingdom, to order it and establishment, all this sort of stuff, right? So there's big expectations. And then Jesus shows up, right, if we sort of follow through the narrative, and he's a baby born to a poor family from this sort of backwater town, right? Or backwater, yeah, Galilee and Nazareth. It's like the lowest of the low. He can't even find his parents can't even find a place for him to be born. He has to be born literally in a barn. And so you have this very different reality from what the expectations were. And this is not sort of, and so he wasn't recognized as Messiah, right? And this is not a critique of like Judaism or the ancient Israelites or anything like that, because obviously we nowadays, as the sort of Christian mainstream, wouldn't recognize that either, right? And we don't recognize it. We tend to rework the story in order to make Jesus this king figure, this conqueror, especially in sort of like the even mainline evangelical ideas about the end of the world or Revelation, right, where Jesus is going to come back and conquer and throw all the sinners in hell to burn forever like a prince of peace would do. And you know, there's sort of this expectation that, okay, maybe he wasn't a king then, but he's going to be a king soon, right? And the reality is of Jesus, of Christ as a person in the time, and here's the thing that would probably get me kicked out of most churches, we'll see what happens, but Jesus was a loser, right, in his time. He was poor, he wandered around the desert, probably didn't smell very well, got a lot of people upset, and got killed. And according to, you know, in the narrative of history, that's not exactly a successful king, right? So, again, there's this idea there that this, between the expectation of what the Messiah was supposed to be and the reality, there's this gap. And the tree, I think, sort of epitomizes that, in that it is the ugly thing that is beautiful to those who can recognize its beauty. So in the film, that's basically Charlie Brown and Linus. They can see the beauty in the ugliness, right? So I just wanted to read this quote from a guy named Adam Gopnik, who is a writer for The New Yorker, but he wrote this book a few years ago all about winter and sort of this idea of the beauty in sort of, you know, we think of winter as this ugly season, things die, it's cold. But he wrote this really interesting book about the beauty in that. A book that I love so much that I actually took it to Paris with me this summer because Adam Gopnik was speaking at a conference I was going to, and I hung around to try and meet him. And I did. I got him to sign it. We had a great chat about the Jets, and it was fun. Anyway, if you don't know Adam Gopnik, read more of The New Yorker. You'll see him a lot. So he writes about this idea of the nativity and the idea of Christ as a baby in the book. So he writes, the truth about Christmas is not that modern people have domesticated and democratized a spiritual impulse, but instead that we have made material an idea that is material at its very core. That is the idea of the nativity, that the infinite idea, the permanent presence, the thing beyond all things, might become the finite fact, the impertinent infant, that thing that wets itself at night, that kid in the corner, right? So this is the idea of the nativity, that God, the thing beyond all things that exists and is all-powerful and all that sort of stuff, would exist in the world as the most vulnerable of things, right? An infant baby that needs to, that will cry in the middle of the night, that can't control its bladder, all of these sorts of things, and must be completely cared for. And that's what we celebrate in this moment, is the renewal of that idea. And so I think that, yeah, that ties into this idea of the tree, right? The least likely thing becomes a thing of beauty if we can appreciate it. And so in the end of the film, in addition to sort of Charlie Brown being accepted into his community, which I think is really beautiful, there's also this moment where they sort of celebrate the tree as it is, right? And there's a cynical way of reading that, which you could say they're just burying the tree under the trappings of commercialized Christmas. But I like to think that's not the case. we could argue about it, but there's something really beautiful about the moment where the kids kind of look at it, and it's got the one ball that's hanging and it's dragging down. And Linus wraps his blanket around it, you know, which is his most precious item in the world, right? And he gives it to the tree and sort of stands it up. And then the other kids take the things from Snoopy's doghouse and surround the tree with it and make it into this thing that's beautiful. And so, yeah, again, we can...
Well, it's a cartoon. We got to remember that, too.
Yeah.
The actual tree might not...
No, it wouldn't work in real life. But that's the beauty of cartoons, right? It's the beauty of cinema. Things can happen there that can't happen in real life, and that's why we watch it. But so what I think of that scene is this moment where the kids are bringing their traditions, their ideas of Christmas, the things that they find beautiful in the season, and they're bringing it to the tree to add to what they see there. And so that's something that we all do every Christmas, right? Is we bring the things that make us happy, our traditions, our whatever, we bring it to the story, and we create our own Christmas out of it. So that's why Christmas is so different, right? From culture to culture, from country to country, and even from house to house, right? What was, you know, when you get married, you always discover is like, what, you want to do what at Christmas time? That's not what we do at Christmas time. And you build this blending out of that, and it doesn't always work, but sometimes you make it work, and it becomes, Christmas becomes your thing. And so I think what's really beautiful about that image is that it doesn't mean we have to align ourselves with someone else's idea of what Christmas is, right? We don't have to create the perfect Christmas that shows up at the end of a Hallmark movie. We don't have to feel like George Bailey every Christmas at the end of It's a Wonderful Life. But we can still find beauty in the way we construct things. And we can find beauty in the ugly things and turn them into beautiful things. So it's like in 1 Corinthians, there's this verse that has stuck with me for a long time. It meant something very different to me when I was a teenager than it does now. But 1 Corinthians 1:27 says, God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. And shame is an interesting word there, but I think at the essence of that verse is this idea that God doesn't select the things that we would expect to be the sort of harbingers of perfection, but instead, you know, sort of introduces the ugly in quotation marks to be the beautiful in quotation marks. And so on that note, we're going to do communion. Again, we don't have music because I wanted to sort of just interact with different media kind of stuff. But as we do communion, I want to show us something that is not Christmas related, but really I think gets to the core of this idea. And so this is a song from a band called the Decemberists, who I'm sure some of you know. And they put out a song this summer called Once in My Life. And it's an interesting song in the same way that the Christmas Time Is Here song is interesting, because it's a song where the lyrics are very sort of down and kind of sad, set to a very upbeat melody. And so it's the opposite of what it was, but it gets into that idea of the gap as well. And so they made this music video out of it. And I want to read sort of the guy from the Decemberists' explanation of it, and the director of the music videos, explanation, because otherwise I think we could see this as maybe a little bit mocking of a person who is developmentally and sort of physically different. And so I don't want that impression to come out. So Colin Molloy, again, the guy who wrote the song and the lead singer of the band, wrote this in regard to this video. We were searching for a video idea for Once in My Life, that's the name of the song, that would somehow capture the spirit of the song. In my mind, the song is a meditation, a plea to the cosmos that I imagine everyone at some point or another has made. We asked our old friend and collaborator, Autumn DeWilde, to pitch an idea, and she came to us with a simple but powerful story, a depiction of her brother Jacob, a man who has lived with physical and intellectual differences his entire life. And he would be dancing in the streets of Los Angeles. The song, in this light, becomes more than just a celebration of sadness, which I, Colin Molloy, sometimes have called it, but suddenly a longing holler to the universe against one's perceived otherness. This idea is particularly close to me as I've witnessed how the world sees my son, Hank, who is autistic. When I'm out in public with Hank, I'm acutely aware of the world's attachment to social and behavioral norms. In these situations, Hank's otherness can suddenly be put into stark relief. Through the lens of Jacob's joyful and defiant movement in Autumn's video, we see a man shrugging off the constraints and unaccommodating and judgmental world, and truly reveling in his mind and body. So that's what he says. And then Autumn DeWilde is the director, this is her brother. He writes, "My brother Jacob is 7'2". His feet size is 22. He has auditory processing disorder. He likes to dress up as Chewbacca. He is not a basketball player. And this video is my love letter to him." And she goes on to sort of explain her process in this, but I think it'd be interesting just to see what she does with it. So we're gonna watch this and I'll pass around the communion and then, yeah, we'll close up. But yeah, just think about this in the context of that gap, the context of Charlie Brown's Little Christmas Tree, and sort of this idea of finding beauty, quote unquote, within, quote, ugliness. And ugliness is such a strange word, that's why I put it in quote, because there's nothing ugly about this person, but there's a perceived cultural ugliness. And so, yeah, we'll engage with that.